You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we'll hear from the two candidates running in the July 7th special election for the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. The winner will serve the remaining 18 months of the recently resigned supervisor, Jeremy Taylor's term. Also, how COVID-19 is spreading in Dickinson County. But first, details on the back-to-school plans of the Sioux City Community School District. This fall, Sioux City Public School students could be attending class in person, use a hybrid model, or learn online. That was the decision made at a meeting of the school board on Monday. The board approved a return-to-learn plan for this fall. Concerns about the spread of COVID-19 closed schools in mid-March, and they never reopened. The spread of the coronavirus would determine the level of in-person schooling. Board President Jeremy Saint said the vote for this skeleton plan means more work needs to be done. I spoke this morning with Sioux City School Superintendent Paul Gosman about how decisions would be made to go to school in person, have a hybrid program, or to learn virtually.
Well, those will be local decisions that will be made by, well, frankly, by me as the superintendent of schools, but will be made with guidance, obviously, from the governor's office, the Department of Education, Iowa Department of Public Health. Siouxland District Health has been a great partner. Community Health Center has been a great partner to us. And so we'll make decisions based on the best known health information and statistics available at that time. And you are correct that there are three options, one being what we would refer to as traditional instruction. It's what most people know in public schools. One being a hybrid where some instruction will be in person and in that traditional model, but some of it will be digital and online. And then, of course, we've got a model for virtual instruction. And it is possible, I want to be clear, that we could use more than one of those at the same time. There might be some students who are receiving virtual instruction at home because they're immunocompromised or some other reason, from staff members who might not be in the buildings either. Yet we might have a lot of classrooms that are actively engaged in traditional learning. And so it's possible we could have a situation where two or three of the three possibilities are engaged all at once.
It does seem like flexibility is a really big part of this plan. And there, you were discussing issues like the technology that students would need if they were learning virtually. It sounds like every student will have some tech to work from home on, and you guys are also working on internet availability, right?
That is correct. So we believe right now that we will have a device for every student so that that student could take that device home. And I use that term device because not every student will have the same device. They'll have different technology available to them by grade level. And of course, it is, you know, paramount that we treat internet connectivity much like we treat water service. You know, everybody needs clean and healthy water available to them. And we need clean and healthy and robust internet service available if we're going to do the hybrid or the virtual models. And it's something that is, you know, a real challenge that has come forward through this COVID-19 pandemic, because we're finding places where there may be some spotty internet connectivity, but not the kind of robust connectivity we would require to be able to, you know, instruct students at the level that they deserve.
There was a long conversation about students and teachers wearing masks, when they would wear masks, how that would be enforced. And I assume that that conversation will continue.
It will continue. You know, I can tell you what we would do if we were starting school tomorrow in person. And, you know, certainly we would have some level of requirement of masks if that were the case. As I talked to you on June 24th, noting that August 24th or 25th is when we actually will begin this process with our full complement of students. And so much could change between now and then. But at this time, we do believe that students will need a mask, staff will need a mask, and that we will provide those where we can, and that there will be some portion of their day where they will, you know, be expected to wear those masks as a part of making their way around the building, or should they, you know, be out on a playground, or you know, I'm not indicating that recess or playgrounds will, you know, be enacted exactly the same way that we all think of them, and you know, certainly we'll have to put some other restrictions in place as well, such as food service and physical education, instrumental music. I mean, there are all kinds of things to think through here.
It seems like this coronavirus pandemic has really caused us to think differently about a lot of things and look at things in a way we never looked at them before. And I know it's been a huge challenge for a lot of sectors. I think education, especially K through 12, has had to really do some innovative things. I mean, do you think that this is going to change the way that educators work in the future?
Yeah, I not only think that it will change the way that we work, but I think it should. You know, we're living in a different world than most of us, you know, grew up in, you know, when we were younger. And yet the educational system has been slow to change. We still live in somewhat of an agrarian society, a kind of an industrialized calendar. You know, I do believe and always will believe that the best instruction given to students is given directly and in person with teachers in the classroom with the students. But we certainly know there are reasons why that might not always be available or possible. And we've been slow adopters of the technological advancements that have come. And I think there are not many silver linings of a global pandemic, but one of them would be that it's causing us to reinvent the way in which we work. And I think that's been good.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about this or tell people?
No, I look forward to, well, yeah, there would be one thing. It'd be simply for people to understand that the plan that we put together and that we deliver and will be approved by the Department of Education is just that. It's a plan, and plans change. And so I would ask for our community's grace and their patience as we work our way through that. Certainly something we have in the plan will sound right when we first create it, but will show itself to be a decision that needs some adjustment. And I would ask for their patience as we make those adjustments and work hard to communicate with everybody as we're working through this together.
That was Sioux City Community School Superintendent Paul Gosman talking about the district's Return to Learn program that will be in place when school starts on August 24th. Sioux City Public Schools shut down for the year on March 13th because of concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Dickinson County is one spot in Iowa seeing a surge of COVID-19. The popular vacation area saw just 7 cases before the Memorial Day weekend. 4 weeks after that, there were more than 200 people infected. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talked to Annie Craig, who's a 21-year-old University of Iowa student who was spending the summer at the Iowa Great Lakes region when she was impacted by the novel coronavirus. She urges people of all ages to heed health advice.
I started feeling sick on Saturday night, I think it was the 13th, and I was just having like some chest pain, and then I thought it would go away, but the next day it got worse, and also a sore throat came with it. So then I decided to get tested on the next day that I could, which was Monday, which my symptoms had already gone away by then. And then I waited until Wednesday to hear back that I was positive. And then I started to feel really sick again. Just this time with fevers and body aches really bad, wasn't able to sleep, chills, throwing up, diarrhea, all flu-like symptoms. And then that lasted for about 2 or 3 days. And then I've been pretty all right since.
And you were able to go to a Test Iowa site. Is that where you end up going up in Sioux Center?
Yep, it was really quick and easy.
But you were telling me your actual doctor's office that you try to go to locally said you weren't sick enough.
Yeah, I first went to the doctor because I called the doctor and they recommended, yeah, you should definitely come in. And then I went in and they were like, oh, actually, you don't have enough symptoms, so we can't test you. So that was actually really frustrating. But once I got to the test Iowa site, I had to drive an hour away, of course, first, but that was easy.
Now, you're a University of Iowa student, but you're spending this summer up at the Iowa Great Lakes. Well, you were until this happened. Now you're in isolation at your parents' home in Sioux City. Where do you think you maybe caught the coronavirus?
I definitely think I got it from the Lakes area, probably from my roommate who works at a bar. She works at like the most, you know, like a hot spot in town. So and she tested positive as well. So I'm assuming just from sharing a house and same bathrooms, I acquired it from her.
Did she have symptoms? Did she get sick?
No, I had symptoms way before she did, which was really weird. And she hardly had any symptoms.
And I think that's kind of what you want people to know, right? Is that, you know,
yeah,
you were a younger person, but you still did get sick.
Yeah, I felt so miserable, so miserable.
You know, many people I'm talking to, a lot of people now feel that people aren't taking the precautions like they should. What do you think about wearing masks after what you've been through and what you're seeing out there and how some people, you know, don't even have symptoms?
Yeah, I think it's so important that you should wear a mask because you can be an unknown carrier. I think my friend has it right now and I've told him to wear a mask everywhere and he's like, well, I don't think I have it. But I was like, just in case you have to, because if you do, you know, breathe on someone or accidentally cough on someone, you know, it's just too easy and you forget because you don't think you're sick and then there it goes, passes to the next.
And what did the health department tell you to do? How long do you have to kind of stay in isolation at home back here in Sioux City?
So they told me once my fever stopped for 3 days straight without help of any medication, on the fourth day, I'm free to live as normal again.
And are you almost there? It's Monday right now, the 22nd of June. Are you almost there?
Yeah, I have two more days left. Wednesday, I should be clear.
You say that you feel better today, but I wish you the best in your recovery.
Thank you so much.
That was Annie Craig, a 21-year-old Sioux City native, talking about her experience with COVID-19. Annie isn't sure if she will return to the Iowa Great Lakes this summer or stay in Sioux City with her family. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Police Department recently expanded services to partner with mental health producers and other organizations to better respond to people with mental health problems. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talked to both the Sioux City Police Department and a mental health expert who oversees the program. She also explores the impact of COVID-19 on mental health. Let's start the conversation with Officer Andrew Dutler of the Sioux City Police Department.
Mobile Crisis Assessment Team is a partnership that the Sioux City Police Department has with Sioux Rivers Assessment Center, and it allows us the opportunity to get mental health professionals involved with calls that we're responding to where mental health is the primary issue. And so as officers and as a department, we go to quite a few mental health and crisis-related calls. And when we show up, we know that sometimes those individuals need more than a 20 or a 30 minute conversation to really help them out. And by calling MCAT, which responds in 60 minutes or under, they bring with them at least two mental health professionals. And those two mental health professionals are then able to determine whether or not that person might need like a mental health placement or even referral to like a therapist or a counselor. The number one bonus is that we get the citizens we serve what they need in that moment. And so that's the biggest benefit. But the other benefits as well is sometimes when we respond to these crises, they are non-criminal matters. And so the MCAT will free officers up to then handle those more criminal matters. And it also alleviates some of our emergency room or emergency department staff at the two hospitals in Sioux City thereby not taking patients as a first option to the ER, but rather seeing if there's something more appropriate before that.
You've been doing this since November of last year. How much of an impact have you noticed? Do you have some hard facts, or what are you seeing?
We've seen huge success. And so in the number of times we've been called out since November of 2019, we've seen about a 74 to 75% diversion rate from our emergency departments, which is telling us, the department, along with our partners, our MCAT partners, we are in fact getting people to where they need to go. And like I said, whether that be a mental health placement or just some ongoing counseling, some follow-up care, with a close to 75% diversion rate to the hospitals, we believe what we're seeing is people getting what they truly need. In 2019, our department responded to approximately 2,800, so 2,800 check welfare calls. And those check welfare calls, they're usually pretty vague in nature. However, when we get those calls, it's usually us going to check on someone who's experiencing some sort of mental health crisis. And so a pretty decent percentage of what we do on a day-to-day basis will be impacted by the MCAT partnership with Sioux River. So we're very excited.
It's Nikki Eaton, and my title is Program Director at the Assessment and Stabilization Center and for the MCAT program. So our Assessment and Stabilization Center, we actually opened about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, and that particular program is kind of a mid-level of care for individuals that are experiencing mental health symptoms that are increased, but they don't necessarily warrant hospitalization. It is a voluntary facility, so those individuals were open 24/7. They can show up at any time. They can be referred here by outside resources, such as hospitals or outpatient providers, et cetera. And we have an RN on staff that can do an assessment with them, determine what their needs are, and then if they fit our criteria, they can certainly stay here. It is a short-term stay. It's about 3 to 5 days, but essentially the goal is to help alleviate the symptoms that they're feeling with their mental health and be able to set them up to prepare to go back out in the community. And if there's any resources or referrals that need to be made, such as, you know, getting set up with psychiatric care, therapeutic care, even primary care, that kind of thing, we can do all of that care coordination while they're here at the assessment center, and then do follow up with them after they leave to see how they're doing. And so then with our mobile crisis program, we actually go out in the community with individuals. So if they're experiencing mental health symptoms that are increased, typically it's a professionally based referral call. So law enforcement might call us, an outpatient provider, hospitals if they feel it's appropriate. Those types of places will give us a call and say, listen, I have an individual here. They're experiencing increased symptoms, not quite sure what level of care they would or should be at. Could you help us out a little bit? So that's where it's been really vital with our Sioux City Police Department, is because they're not mental health professionals per se, and so they don't know exactly what to do. Oftentimes, previously, they were just taking them directly to the hospital, where those individuals didn't always meet that higher level of care, but they did need some help. So we can help determine that through our assessment, and then be able to refer them to the appropriate places. So, you know, maybe they're safe enough to stay at home, but they just need some additional support. Or maybe they're a good candidate for our Assessment and Stabilization Center. Or maybe they do need that higher level of care. So really that assessment kind of helps determine that, and then it alleviates the police officer having to determine what to do with that individual. The greatest thing about MCAT is that, just like with the assessment center, we are able to do referrals as well to resources that maybe they don't know of or don't have in place currently. So we are able to say, okay, well, you know, perhaps you need to be set up with psychiatric care or a therapy or a primary care provider, or maybe you don't have access to your medications. So we're looking for all of those missing elements in that person's life and trying to connect them with those resources, so that we can kind of break that cycle of them not knowing what to do. So in that case, once we've met with that individual and we've de-escalated that situation in the moment, we're also doing follow-up care. So 24 hours, 7 days, 14 days, 30 days, even beyond that point, just to make sure that they're getting access to the resources that they need and then assisting them accordingly as appropriate.
Nikki, when it comes to resources, We always hear about a shortage when it comes to mental health providers. Is that true here in Sioux City and Siouxland?
As a whole, there are a lot of providers out there, but yes, I mean, the issue with that, with the shortage in providers, is that it may take longer for an individual to get in to be seen. And so the providers are there, but it just takes some time. So I know at least with Siouxland Mental Health, which is my employer, we have made a lot of effort to at least be able to do immediate crisis appointments, so same-day crisis appointments. We have been able to minimize our psychiatric time frame for getting in to see psychiatry to about 7 to 10 days. So that's a huge thing. Previously, it could sometimes be 30 days to 60 days before people were getting in to see psychiatry services. And in that circumstance, that's just way too long. And so when people are in crisis, oftentimes they're going immediately to the hospital. So really what we're looking to do is to divert those hospital visits, kind of alleviate what's going on in the hospitals, and being able to intervene prior to that to be able to get them the care that they need.
Also, when it comes to care, I would think the whole COVID-19 pandemic is adding a whole new layer to the stress that people feel, especially not only people that the Sioux City police officers come in contact with, but just everyone in general.
Absolutely. I know that I've talked to several providers who have said that, you know, they're treating a lot more for anxiety and depression due to COVID-19. Obviously, when you are isolated in your home for such a long amount of time and you're not able to communicate with your loved ones, your friends, your family, that kind of thing, it does take a toll on your mental health. And then the fear of the unknown, what does this look like, you know, and, you know, where is this country going, and, you know, as the world as a whole, you know, so it does cause a lot of anxiety, depressive symptoms, that kind of thing. So what we've done to try to help with that as an organization is to provide telehealth services. Mobile Crisis has been responding regardless of what's going on with COVID, whether it's via telehealth or actually still going out in the community. And our Assessment Stabilization Center has remained open as well, 24 hours a day. So, you know, while many businesses were shutting down or limiting their ability to service the mental health population, we have kept it in our forefront to ensure that our services remain available to those folks that need it.
What would you suggest people do? I know we're kind of going off the topic of what you're doing to help the Sioux City Police Department, but what would you suggest people do, or what are some of those signs that people need to look out for when it comes to, hey, I'm getting too stressed out, or I might be a little depressed?
So really what we're looking for is anything that disrupts their normal, functional, daily living activities, you know? So if they're finding it more difficult to go to work or participate in family events, or, you know, even just doing general chores or activities that they typically do, that's what they're looking for. So there any disruption that's causing some change in their lifestyle. So in those circumstances, you know, it's just really important to recognize that it's okay that you're feeling this way. They're not the only ones. And definitely to reach out for some additional support. The nice thing is there's, you know, several 24-hour hotlines available, whether it's, you know, the national one, or there's one through the state of Iowa now that they can access. And then Siouxland Mental Health also has a 24-hour hotline that they can call too. So there's a lot of resources out there that we recommend that individuals reach out if they ever have questions or just need some additional support. And then too, just with the assessment center as well, you know, if they feel like they just don't feel comfortable staying home alone and they need someone to talk to, they can always present here too. And we have staff that are able to kind of assist and support them through that process too.
Why did you decide to get into the field that you work in today?
I honestly have been in healthcare for over 20 years. I've explored many different things, long-term care, intellectual disability care, brain injury care. But my love has always been for those with mental health needs. You know, it just fascinates me, you know, the symptoms that are occurring and how people manage it and cope with it. And, you know, just having that, you know, everyone says it takes a special person to work with folks that have any sort of disability or mental health needs. And for some reason, I was blessed with that. And I just feel that, you know, if I can help somebody's life better, even just for that one little small moment of their day, then I've made a huge step in impacting lives. So that's my goal, is just make things better and try to help improve the struggles that they go through every single day. You know, as we got off the topic of the Sioux City Police Department, I just want to say that they have been fantastic to work with this process. They have been a vital piece of putting this whole program together. We knew that law enforcement was going to be a big part of this because oftentimes they're the ones first responding to individuals that are in mental health crisis. And so I can't say enough wonderful things about our local Sioux City Police Department, in addition to all of our outside departments as well through our 8 counties that we service in the Rolling Hills area. They've all been very, very responsive to this and feel that it's going to be a great partnership to ensure that our individuals with mental health crisis needs are met.
That's Nikki Eaton with the Siouxland Mental Health Center. She's also the program director of the Sioux Rivers Regional Assessment and Stabilization Center and MCAT, the program that started working with the Sioux City Police Department in November. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa farmers have been the recipients of $423.5 million of pandemic payments in COVID-19 relief. That's the most of any state. But critics say the coronavirus program addresses only a small portion of the losses farmers are experiencing. The American Farm Bureau Federation and other major ag groups are pushing Congress to include agriculture in the next coronavirus package. However, Iowa State University economist Chad Hart says that stimulus payments cannot solve other enduring problems like low commodity prices.
I mean, if you think about what the government provided through the coronavirus payments, it was not just hog farmers, but we saw payments going to cattle producers, dairy producers, crop farmers, even fruit and vegetable growers. And it was in response to not only the production problems that we had, like at the processing plants on the meat side, but we also saw just tremendous drops in prices. And so the payments helped as far as, you know, for some of those farmers, you know, maintaining their cash flow, but it didn't fix the price problem. And for a lot of these crops, prices still remain low. Even with, you know, you mentioned the hogs, the idea is that we're still running behind in terms of there's still a backlog of animals that, you know, should have been processed by now that haven't been. And so there's all sorts of financial hardships right now that are still being stacked up on our farmers and ranchers today.
And what about the China trade deal? I've heard one day it's on, next day it's off.
Well, it's gone through. So both sides have signed it. It's just a question of, okay, will both sides meet that agreement?
Right.
When we look right now at the data so far, China is buying more agricultural products, but they're not quite buying at the pace that would fully fulfill the deal. And so that's the big question here is, you know, how does this U.S.-China relationship continue to build and grow, or will we see this start and stop, it's on again, it's off again, sort of, you know, tug and pull here that leads to some of the price uncertainty that we're seeing across our agricultural markets.
How is COVID continuing to play into this problem? I mean, aside from processing the animals?
Well, COVID plays in not just on the processing side, but if you think about it, it's still impacting our ability to just have our normal lives. And I'd say the biggest impact for agriculture is the problems, not only at processing plants, but think about our local restaurants where, you know, they're not able to run at full capacity. I know at least here in central Iowa, we've had a few restaurants open up and then have to shut down because they've got staff that have been infected with COVID. And so you still see major problems within our food delivery sector here within the U.S. because of COVID.
The whole tariff war, is this still basically a hangover from that too?
Well, there is some hangover from that. You know, if you think about it, it's trade relationships are like many relationships that, you know, humans have. The idea is that when you're coming off a period of mistrust, and let's face it, that's what the back and forth tariffs between the U.S. and China were, it's hard to rebuild some of those relationships, and you don't tend to build them back as quickly because of the damage that was done previously.
What about farmers, soybean farmers, corn farmers? Do they have any special issues?
Not necessarily special issues, but, you know, when we're looking here, I would say the problems that happened with the trade war, with COVID-19, these are piling on top of basically just generally low prices that corn and soybean farmers have been facing for the past several years. So you can think of this as just adding to the list of problems that they've had to deal with basically since 2012.
What would be most helpful right now, anyway, from the government? Is there anything that the government could do?
Well, right now you're seeing, I think, the government do what it can do. It's doing a variety of things. There's been the, you know, the direct support, the what they were called the CFAP payments for the coronavirus payments. You've seen the government step up in terms of purchases, buying commodities and then redistributing them through the food banks. And you're also seeing the government look to promote trade. So that's, you know, not only through the phase one deal with China, but we've signed the, you know, the USMCA, a free trade agreement with Korea, a new agreement with Japan, trying to bolster global demand for agricultural products.
It is interesting because farmers are always you know, seen as the most self-reliant of people not wanting to take the handouts. Has that changed over the years? Do they need to have kind of not handouts, but kind of more relationships with the government, with different sectors maybe of the economy?
Well, I would say that's the deal. I think when we think of farmers, we tend to think of that, hate to use the word stereotype, of, yeah, they don't want government support. Agriculture has had and enjoyed good government support, especially direct government support, for at least the last, you know, 40, 50 years. And so, and especially now, given, if you will, the global reach of agriculture, how, you know, when we look at U.S. agricultural production, we depend a lot on our ability to export a lot of our agricultural produce to the rest of the world. You have to sort of do that in concert in working with your government, not only your government, but their governments as well. And so definitely there has to be this symbiotic relationship between agriculture and the government for those global markets to develop.
Do you have any advice for farmers? Anything you could tell them that would be helpful?
Well, I think in this case, what farmers have been dealing with this year has been unprecedented. But at the same time, too, the, let's call it the basic business of agriculture, remains the same. And so I think for a lot of farmers, it's just, you know, remembering what they've done in the past to get themselves through some tough times. And that often means, you know, not only looking to control our costs on the farm, but oftentimes this is where, you know, farmers look to, you know, evaluate, okay, do I need to grow bigger, smaller? Do I need to get that off-farm job? You know, now's the time to really sit down and think about the farm business. And it is a business at the heart of it, and run the farm like a business.
That was Iowa State University economist Chad Hart talking about the problems American farmers have been experiencing because of the novel coronavirus, low commodity prices, recent floods, and tariff battles. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, after a record-breaking primary election in June, Siouxland voters are mailing in thousands of absentee ballots in advance of a special election for a recently vacated seat on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. Republican Jeremy Taylor resigned his seat in January after it was shown he was residing in a home outside of the district he represented on the board. Taylor has 18 months left in the remainder of his term, so the winner of the special election will take over for the year and a half. The two candidates are Democrat Tim Kaczyna and Republican Justin Wright. Tim Kaczyna has been serving as state representative for the 14th District in the Iowa House for years and has decided not to run again. Kaczyna has also spent much of his career as a firefighter and first responder. Kaczyna says the supervisor position wasn't even on his radar when he decided not to run for another term in the House.
I had made the decision earlier not to seek another term at the Iowa House. And when Jeremy Taylor situation came up and that position opened up, I thought, yeah, this is something I can do where I can help the community. I can step in there on day one and be ready to go and bring the expertise that I have to the county board until the next election when somebody else goes up there. So that was my main reason for doing it, is just to keep serving the community alive.
So you see yourself as sort of filling the gap there?
I'm running for the special election at this time, yes, to take that in and take care of those 18 months. And we'll see at that point, you know. We'll decide at that point. I just know that I would like to be a voice in the room here while we're going through. I mean, we're building a $50 million jail, and I want to be a voice in the room there. I want to make sure that we're going to have a mental health component to that new jail that's coming in. We know about 85% of the people that end up in jail have mental health problems as far as the statistics go, and I think that we should be looking into that, see if we can get other dollars, either through mental health dollars through the state or through DHS, so that we can basically start healing the wound and not just keep putting Band-Aids on it.
Do you think that the new jail was needed? That was a pretty controversial issue around here.
It was, but they had to do something. I was surprised to pass, but they had to do something. They either had to invest a lot of money down there, and they still would have had trouble. I had probably about half as much they would have had to invest to get it built back up. But they messed that up a long time ago when they got cheap on it when they first did it. I mean, it was originally designed to last a very long time and to be able to expand above, but they cut back on that and ended up with what we have that got us into this problem right now. But we do, you know, since we're going to have that new jail, though, I don't want it to be just the, prison industrial complex, so to say, where we're going to build a jail and we're just going to have a lot of federal prisoners come in here and fill it up, and that's going to pay for it, because we know if we build them, the government will fill them. And it's just a ongoing thing where we'll just keep locking more people up. And I feel like we should be doing more than that for our community. I think we should be trying to get the people the help they need too, so that they don't end up where they are again, instead of the continuing cycle of going back in again and again and again.
If you are elected in July, obviously this whole COVID-19 situation will still be going on.
I think the county itself has been doing good. I mean, as far as the election part of it and not exposing people, I know Pat Gill sent my absentees out a long time ago. This election was supposed to be back in April, you know. And they moved it to July. So there was a lot of that out there beforehand. Now what we've seen in the last weeks is that that's going to be harder to do now with what they passed down there, because they did basically put in a voter suppression bill down there.
Okay, so you're talking about the absentee voting bill, right?
But what the county did as far as, you know, shutting it down, they took all the precautions. I think they followed everything CDC, so I would say that they did everything they could while dealing with the COVID at this time. My first priority is always going to be public safety. You know, it's what I've had in my whole life. It's going to be my first priority when I go in there. I'm going to work hard to make sure that our volunteers are getting what they need, making sure that we're getting more people involved to become volunteers out there, looking to see what we can do just to get better response times in the county and make sure that they have the roads so that these tankers and fire trucks and what have you aren't going to sink into them when they go answering calls out there, or an ambulance as far as that goes. Right. Infrastructure is my third one that I'm going to be working on. My number one priority is always going to be public safety. Two is going to be the mental health. And three is going to be the infrastructure of our county to make sure that these people can get in and out of their roads down there. And I went down and did a forum down there. I drove a lot of the roads. I had an hour or two beforehand, so I just took long drives on the roads down there, the county roads, to see how they are doing down there. And They need a lot of help down there. They do. I know that the county has already put money into that, I believe, $10 million over so long. I can't tell you exactly the timeline on that. So that's a good start. They're using some of that CF money down there to do that and bonded that out also.
So we're getting there.
Yeah, yeah. With all of the protests and concern, the Black Lives Matter, do you think there's anything that the county could be doing to improve, especially race relations and dealings with law enforcement?
I think we're very fortunate in this area that our leaders in law enforcement already understand this. I mean, it would not surprise me what the governor just implemented. It would not surprise me if we already have those policies in the city police department and county sheriffs. I couldn't swear to that, but it would not surprise me if we already do. And I think that the relations, such as when they had the march, you know, downtown to the police department, they got to the police department and there were coolers full of water for the marchers at that time. I hate to call them protesters, I just call them marchers. But you know, the relationship that Rex and Young and, you know, all the people before them that have been working on this for a while, I think our relations are not bad in Sioux City at this point. So I guess it's all the policies. I'm not familiar with what they're doing right now all the way through, but it won't take long to climb board.
Well, is there anything else you would like to say to people or you think people should know?
You know, I've lived in Sioux City my whole life, and, you know, I've only done service for the community. That's been my life. And this is just another step forward that I can do it again. As I have it, I did it on the fire department, as I did anywhere else. So 33 years, you know, and I started a St. Florian Fire and Burn Foundation. I wrote the first letter to bring Make-A-Wish to Iowa. I've been taking kids, get them hooked on fishing, not on drugs, for over 20 some years. It's just something that I've always done, is worked within the community and tried to serve the people here. And this is just, you know, when Jeremy went out, I thought, well, I'm probably the most qualified to go in there and help these guys out at this point with the experience I've gained from the state office, from my career, my lifetime of service. I just think that I'd probably be the guy to do the job the best. I can go in day one and make a difference.
That was Democrat Tim Kasina. He's currently a state representative for the Siouxland area. He's running in the special election July 7th to finish out the term of Republican Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, who resigned in January. The Republican candidate in this special election is Justin Wright. Wright is a teacher at North High School. Wright says he decided to run after Republican Supervisor Keith Radig asked him to.
Keith reached out to me because I think he was aware of my politics. I think he was aware of kind of where I stood on some things from a spiritual perspective, and also on some things just regard to the way I think about things generally as more conservative thinker. But the main, I don't think I would have jumped in if I hadn't been able to kind of look myself in the mirror a little bit and believe for myself that I was pursuing it for the right reasons. And while this is just my first experience with seeking public office, I think I can look back over my 20-year professional history. I can look back on that time and assert with confidence that I've been a public servant during that time. I've taught with Sioux City Schools for 10 years in alternative ed. And prior to that, I was a teacher at a residential facility for adjudicated boys in central Iowa. And I was in that position for about 3 years. And then prior to that, I'd done some social work. And for the last 15 to 20 years, I've been doing public service. I've been serving the public. I've been working hard and investing in other people's lives to try to make it better for the people that I've been working with. And so if I was coming from any other background, I'm not sure, because of the way I tend to think about things. And the way that I sometimes think about politics, I don't think I would have gotten on board if I thought to myself that this was just a something that I was doing to pursue my own personal agenda or selfish ambitions.
Property taxes are always a concern in Woodbury County. What should be done, do you think, to try and keep property taxes at a reasonable level for most people?
That has been a commitment from day one. It's one of when I first announced my intentions to run, my platform that I put out was number one, trying to keep taxes low. Number two, trying to get some work done on county rural roads. And third, to try to work hard to attract more employers to Sioux City, to try to diversify the job market a little bit further. And specific ideas, I mean, the tax rate is, or people's bottom line when it comes time to pay their tax bill, you know, it comes down to the levy rate, and it comes down to their assessed property values. And so I think that as somebody who's one of five on the board, just my perspective as somebody who wants to deliver on low taxes to people, I think just that attitude will hopefully shape the discussion and the decision making that takes place when it's time to budget. The levy has gone down over the last number of years, but in some cases, people's kind of bottom line figure has still gone up in some cases because of property valuations. And I know personally, just in the last year, I saw my valuation for the first year in the last several years, I saw it go back down. So that was something that I was happy about as a homeowner myself. As those discussions come forward, it's like, as you mentioned, it's the budget comes into play too. It's going to have to be a balance of taking a look at what kind of revenues are projected to come in because of where property valuations are and where that levy is, what kinds of dollars we need to bring in to support quality services in the area. It's going to be a balancing act between that and continuing to try to both lower the levy and continue to encourage the assessor's office to continue to maybe give people some relief on values of property as well. So it's a complex system, I think, but it's one that I think I have a firm understanding of. From a general standpoint, I don't think that I'm prepared yet to dig into some of the details of the budget, just because I haven't done the job yet. I haven't been in the room when those discussions are taking place. I haven't been in the room when the leaders of the different departments are coming in and going over with the board what their needs are going to be for the fiscal year. And I think I'm prepared intellectually for those conversations. And I believe that I'm committed. I think people can trust me when I say that I'm firmly committed to trying to provide tax relief in that regard when those discussions take place.
In the past few months, of course, we've had the coronavirus come through and the shutdown of a lot of services and businesses now starting to open up again. And then on the heels of that, after the death of George Floyd, we've had protests in the county, in the city. There's been a lot of turmoil. And what do you think, or do you have any ideas about what the county could do to, on either one of these fronts, you know, kind of maintain the city and go forward, but keep workers safe, and also sort of to have a, you know, I don't know, a dialogue with the community about racial issues and law enforcement? Do you think that these issues going forward are going to need some work?
I think it would be a mistake for us to believe that Sioux City, because maybe it's a little bit smaller of a community, I think it's a mistake for us to assume that these aren't issues that we don't have to deal with. I think they're very much issues that that we need to be concerned about. I think back into just my years in the classroom and working with alternative ed students, and a number of those students are African American students, and I know from that experience that there's some work that needs to be done with building trust with our Black students and our Black families. There's trust that needs to continue to be built in the institutions of government, of education, of the voting infrastructure. We need to continue to do a better job of having conversations regularly with folks who may have questions about what we're doing and the effectiveness of what we're doing and how much what we're doing is equitable for their community. My number one reaction to issues with George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and others that have taken place here over the last couple months, my personal reaction to that is that I have to continue to do better myself personally at somebody I mentioned before, that my faith is something that's really important to me. It's a basis for which I try to live my life in lots of different areas. And Christ's example was clear. He calls us to be peacemakers. And I try to do that at school on a daily basis. My highest priorities when I step into the classroom day in and day out is I've got to be respectful. I've got to be kind. I have to be somebody who is every single day trying to nurture relationships. And I think that's the attitude and mindset that that as individuals, I think we need to move forward with.
That was Justin Wright. He's a teacher at North High School and the Republican candidate running for the opportunity to serve out the rest of Jeremy Taylor's seat on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. Taylor resigned in January. He has 18 months left on his term. That special election is set for July 7th. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks so much to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith. We'll see you next week.